Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety-first L2, accelerating the transition to an on-chain financial system. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the episode, but for now, on with the program.
All right, welcome back to another roundup edition of On the Margin. This week we've got the triumvirate again, as Mike is jet-setting to, looks like Italy this time, so you know, he's just jet-setting around the world. How you guys doing?
Fantastic. Happy Friday.
Yeah. Quinn looks like, was it Steve Jobs turtleneck today? What's going on there?
No, it's my vest, man. So I can wear any t-shirt I want. But yeah.
Oh, you got the venture capital look going or something.
Yeah. The VC bro.
Can't escape it. Can't escape it.
Yeah. What shirt are we rocking today, Tyler?
This is just, I'm basically camouflage today. So you can't really see me.
Nothing was crazy last week.
I got to give someone credit. He was like, Tyler looks like a 1970s gigolo in a shirt last week. Bitcoin only.
You're getting more and more out of hand.
Yeah, keep please. It's so good.
Yeah. All right. Well, lots to get into. Lots going on. Yesterday was quite an eventful day. We had the GD print come out, and it came out quite a bit softer than what most of the expectations were. I think the Atlanta Fed had it at for Q1 2024 at 2.7%, and it came out at 1.6%, which that paired with we had an estimate around core PCE that was quite a bit hotter than what a lot of people expected. Started to get a lot of the Fintuit macro observers to start claiming that we're entering an era of stagflation, which was, you know, a very loaded term that gets a lot of people spooked quite easily. So really wanted to just start by digging into the specific contributions to GDP, because I think there's a lot more nuance when you dig into it. So just got here, basically the contributions for each component of GDP. And just as a quick reminder of what actually goes into the number calculation of GDP is basically you have consumption, investment, government spending, and then net exports, which is just the imports subtracted by the exports of the country. And it was really interesting. Like, as you can see here, a lot of the reason for this downtick in GDP was actually due to net exports. Specifically, the differential between imports and exports. So for me, when I'm looking at this and just that comparison, is that, okay, well, we had a super strong consumption reading. Government spending has been going down. But to me, when I see imports that are just exploding higher and exports that are slowing down, paired with the U.S. economy just basically reaccelerating while every other global economy is slowing down, that's telling me that there's just the U.S. dollar and the U.S. consumer is just so strong compared to others that it's actually making some pretty wonkish reactions in GDP. We had a huge import reading. If you just look specifically at imports and exports, you can see that the reason it came down was counterintuitively, in my opinion, because the economy is so strong that the imports are just coming in at a feverish pace, whereas exports are slowing down because the rest of the global economy is struggling. So to me, this is like the opposite of stagflation. This is just affirmation that the U.S. economy is so strong relative to other economies that it's just, you know, basically steamrolling everything. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I was curious if you, Felix, had any thoughts or saw anything about what people project, like the reversion of that to be. Is that like typically a metric that reverts and we'll see some in the opposite direction that'll actually be a boon to GDP readings the rest of the quarters?
Yeah, it might be. Obviously the seasonal adjustments can always create some pretty wonky reactions when you start to look at it long term. This was a really nice chart that I was looking at, which just shows the more long-term average and then also compares the previous quarter. And overall, like if you look at this, you can see like the consumption, especially for like services, was super, super strong. Way above trend, way above the previous quarter. Durable goods was lower. But again, like this to me is just this weird situation right now. And it reminds me a lot of like 2022. The same thing happened where we got these two quarters of negative GDP prints and everybody started calling it a recession. But really, it was just because of these weird mechanics behind net exports. But when you look at the consumption component of GDP, it's just booming. So, I mean, I think as they start to normalize away from the seasonal adjustments, there could be some changes. But to me, like, I just saw the Atlanta Fed came out with their next quarter estimate, and that thing's super volatile. But it's already back up at like 3.9%. So, I mean, to me, I don't see anything stagflation about this. I just see it an economy that's starting to overheat, especially in comparison to other global economies.
Yeah, that other chart you had, it was interesting, that showed the net import exports going back in quarters. When I first saw it, I couldn't help but notice the similarity to 2022 Q1 as well, which I know a lot of aspects of the market, not just the GDP reading here, there's some confluence to 2022 with rising commodities, you know, the inflationary pressures re-emerging. And I also think, you know, you have this kind of trend down in consumption, still strong on that other side you had, but the trend is a bit lower. So I wonder if, what was it, Q3, Q4 that we had those slip negative readings, or was it Q2, Q3 of 22?
I think it was, what was that?
The time period where it was like a technical recession.
2022 Q1, it looks like, was that one. What's your read, Tyler?
Man, I feel like we're just in a holding pattern. There's nothing really crazy. It seems like a lot is going on, but nothing's really going on at the same time. Like last week, we got a sell-off in oil. I think a lot of it's just really political, in my opinion. And we're in the same spot price-wise, at least in terms of Bitcoin, as we were last week. But everyone wants to get extreme on either side of it. When it's rallying, everyone's like, oh my God, it's going to break out. And you know, I do think that's inevitably where we end up, but I don't know. This data is nothing crazy in my opinion. Like, everyone's talking stagflation, but I think stagflation is like, you know, when rates of inflation are way higher than they are. So I'm not getting, although I will say, like, the gold market has my ears perked up a little bit. I talked to some Canadian brokers this week, and they basically said U.S. accounts who've been unallocated to precious metals in Canada for a long time are now allocating dollars to certain stocks. And like, you can see a lot of the gold miners specifically are breaking out from levels, you know, they haven't been in a year. So that's kind of interesting. Surprised Bitcoin's not going with it, especially with the yen imploding here. But yeah, I don't know. I think we're kind of just in this weird holding pattern. You know, obviously tech earnings, which we'll probably get into in a sec, they've been kind of bipolar, and there's some winners and losers. But I think what we're going to head into after this like little period of mini volatility is the VIX is going to roll off again. I mean, we kind of saw that last week when it was bid up and there was an inversion, and we'll get back into the buyback scenario because there's no real credit problems just yet. Like, I don't think that's all been through. So it's kind of looking at right now.
I think that's a good point. The basically, like, you know, Vincent Delaware, I think, had a good example of this where he said, you know, we're not going to have those same recessions that we had. And we've talked about this on the show for a while. When fiscal spending is this high, you put a floor on economic activity. And that's kind of what happened with this print. Like, there's really not anything new. Okay, we learned the U.S. consumer stronger than rest of world. We already knew that. We found out that rest of the world is weaker. You know, you can see that in the central bank postures. You can see that inflation. The U.S. is now actually higher inflation than UK, EU, Japan, which has been a first for a number of years. It's been stickier. It's kind of like, not a ton of new information. It seems like the market needs a bit of a catalyst here.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety first layer 2 that is accelerating the transition to the on-chain financial system. Now, I know we're all very excited about tokenization. Larry Fink certainly is. He's on CNBC talking about it all the time. And I know we're all very excited about L2s. Here's the problem though. If we want L2s to onboard the financial system, there's a lot of stuff that we still need. And Kinto is basically rolling out solutions for that. So one, it features user-owned KYC, which is just table stakes for our regulated friends. And if we want the institutional capital to come in, Kinto offers a really good solution for that. They also have native account abstraction that solves some of the largest problems with onboarding in terms of security and user experience today, which is still very confusing. So if we want to bring more folks onto Ethereum, Kinto is the way to do that. And if you believe in this on-chain financial system and you actually want to get more active in Kinto and become a founding member, you should join their launch program, which is Engine. That's E-N-G-N. You can see a link in the show notes. So if you're a part of that, you can do things like participate in Kinto governance, the launch ceremony, and priority access to product launches on Kinto. You get reduced fees and unique discounts on products launched on Kinto. So overall, if you want to be a part of Kinto and the mission that they have, I would go click the link, join the Engine program, and thank me later.
Like, it really feels like the market wants, and you know, financial media overall wants a narrative to latch onto. And you know, we had the spring yesterday, and it's like, all right, let's go with the stagflation idea. But I don't know. I think it, totally right. Like we're on the precipice of a lot of an inflection point. I think, you know, nobody wants to get over their skis and start talking too much about the Fed's you know, pivoting to back to hawkish. You know, we're waiting on the QRA from Yellen, which we'll talk about more later. But yeah, it really seems like we're just sort of waiting for something to happen. Tyler, you mentioned that the yen was breaking down. Do you want to chat a bit about what you're seeing?
Yeah, this kind of surprised me. And basically, the yen's at 157.37 right now. It's down a full percent, which is pretty big for any currency. You know, currencies are generally less volatile than other assets. And, you know, I was anticipating the BOJ would come out super hawkish, they defend the yen and you'd get kind of a sell-off in the dollar. And that clearly hasn't happened, which makes me think there's something going on in Asian currencies. And, you know, the yuan was defended, the Korean won, the dong was defended a little bit, but the yen is not. And so it's something that I keep watching because you don't want their bond market to get away from them, because that is literally the mother of all debt bubbles. So I don't know exactly. I think what you're going to have is some sort of quasi accord situation if the inflation gets too bad over in Japan, because you can't have one of the largest buyers of yield in the world just selling bonds. That affects us, right? They own a lot of like US debt. They've been basically buying US debt with their yen. Now they're repatriating. So this is something that will come to a head eventually. And you know, we haven't seen like super spike in credit spreads just yet. We haven't seen, but it's something that your antenna should definitely be up about the yen.
Mm-hmm. What there's always seems to be this dilemma for the US is, you know, do they care about foreign interests and acting as the owner of the reserve currency, or do they act for domestic interests? And, you know, there's an election coming up. You know, if you have reaccelerating inflation into that, that's not going to be a good look. So, you know, on one hand, it's like, yes, a Plaza Accord of some sort eventually probably may need to occur, because the US dollar is just so strong compared to everything else right now, because every other global economy is starting to basically fall over. But that's not great for domestic interests if inflation is reaccelerating. How do you think these U.S. leaders are trying to decide which way to go?
I can go there because I've been thinking about this one a lot. It's an interesting pivot point where our interests are actually pretty, our incentives are pretty opposing to our key allies in this situation, where Japan is sitting here with, you know, 0 to 1% interest rates, the 30 years at under 2, the 10 years under 1, and their short-term rate is 0 to 0.1. So effectively zero interest rates, and their debt service cost annually is already 25% of their budget, which, you know, you hear all these doomers in the US talk about, you know, we're not going to be able to service our debt, blah, blah, blah. It's 3% in the US, and our rates are 2 to 3 times higher, and it's 25% in Japan at basically zero rates. So that gives you the magnitude of this problem. Japan is in a place where their yields are rising, their bonds are selling off while their currency's selling off, devaluing, which is the market's way of saying your monetary policy is too loose relative to where inflation and growth is. But they're not doing anything about it. And the reason is, if they hike rates to fix the bond market, it's just this reflexive problem. Okay, now their interest expense is 50% of annual budget. and they have to fund, you know, issue more debt to finance that. So it's this kind of like point of no return where Japan can't really do much. And then they're kind of looking at the US. Yellen's like, well, that sucks for you, but if we, you know, dampen the dollar, pump liquidity, which we've done four times in the last year and a half, you know, while inflation was going down, where inflation is going up now, that creates, you know, domestic problems. So I think it's this real crossroad here where we're going to the tough decisions, when there were no tough decisions in October 2022 when they backstopped the yen and dropped the dollar, or March 23 or October 23, because inflation was coming down. Now it's a completely different game, and we don't know how it's going to shake out. Like, there's a ton of path dependencies here. We have a good sense that they're going to choose to inflate and support the markets, but usually the markets end up forcing their hand. But I think that's the difference here versus these previous situations that make it a little more uncertain, just given that aspect is newer.
I'm guessing they're going to run the SPR down to zero here, because, you know, we're locked.
Yeah.
That's all they can do. Yeah.
And any oil spike will probably be sold into in terms of that, or they'll go over to Saudi Arabia and just like give us concessions to have some more supply, or stuff like that will have to happen if dollar liquidity is cutting off, you know, creating a credit crisis in Asia. You don't want Japan to go into a credit crisis, because they are going to be our number one exporter in replace of China, if like China relations. So we're at this real funky geopolitical precipice, I think, and you have to be really gentle.
There's also a second order here, and we're getting a little bit like, this is like the next around the corner. But in other ways, the devaluation of all these global currencies versus the dollar has been probably a huge boon for dollar assets. You know, the yen carry trade, where you borrow in at 0% in the yen and go invest in dollars, and you get dollar appreciation plus US dollar asset appreciation, and you go pay back the 0% debt. That's effectively, you know, it's hyper driven in Japan, but it's effectively what's happening in other global economies in Europe and stuff too. So there's this, I think what we'll see later this year is, you know, you get near term positive reactions from any liquidity and market support response here, but it might not be as long lived as previous, because if you end up reversing that carry trade where the dollar's been appreciating, people have just stayed in the US, you know, you could see some, you know, that reversal down the road for risk at US assets.
Yeah. It's a hard time to be a global central bank. You know, for the past 20 years, basically every other central bank could just follow what the US Fed is doing. But that's not the case anymore. I mean, I know here in Canada, like, our economy's rolling over. We've had pretty like low inflation compared to the US, but, you know, so the Bank of Canada really wants to cut rates in June, but, you know, if they do that and the Fed is not going to be cutting until, like, I don't know, at least December, like, our Canadian dollar is just going to start falling off a cliff. Just, you know, like, there's a huge issue.
Yeah. I loved Biden's tax proposal this week, which is like, the only way to fix this is fiscal. Like, not saying you're supposed to tax at 50% and spend like, you know, crazy people, but you have to balance the budget. So like, either you bring down spending or you increase revenues. And that's like, so if you're not going to bring down spending, increase revenues. So like, one of the only way solutions out, and everyone's just like, absolutely not. Like, so it just shows you where sentiment in this kind of populism era is around, you know, that whole balanced budget idea. It's a thing of the past for a little bit, I think.
Yeah, that was just a political virtue signaling, I think. Just like, I was laughing at Trudeau being like, you know, we have to take care of the people who can't buy homes in Canada, and they've really alienated. I'm like, is this guy joking with us right now? Like, not, it's just kind of nuts. They're almost like, it's like some weird cognitive dissonance that they say all the things that they created. It's really bizarre.
It's super weird. Anyway, shifting gears a little bit, obviously big week for earnings right now. We had Google come out yesterday and beat pretty decently. They had what was it, $1.89 EPS versus the expected $1.51. They also announced the first ever dividend and a $70 billion buyback program starting. We had Microsoft beat earnings. We had Meta beat earnings. They did, you know, go lower just on guidance due to the huge AI CapEx program that's coming up, which spooked a little bit. But I mean, on their actual earnings, they did great. We even saw Snapchat beat expectations. That just really tells you about, you know, at least a theory that I have is that I wanted to show this chart here. But this is from George Robertson, the Monetary Frontier. He's been putting out some really great charts lately. And this one's just of nominal GDP to corporate profits as a linear regression here. And, you know, basically as nominal GDP increases, we see a pretty linear increase in corporate profits. And to me, like the key driver of nominal GDP right now is increasing inflation. So, you know, you have increasing inflation that's leading to higher nominal GDP. Earnings, you know, revenue and even just like EPS is a nominal metric. It's not a real metric. So, you know, we're seeing these huge increases. So for me, I had this working theory that, okay, you know, we're seeing the economy reaccelerate. We're seeing a nominal GDP that's starting to run hot. It would make sense to me to see earnings start to, you know, continue to beat expectations because we're underestimating how strong the economy is right now. So for me, it was quite validating to see basically every major tech company, even freaking Snapchat, beat expectations. That's like, okay, something's happening here. So for me, it's like, okay, if these earnings continue to beat expectations, as long as that doesn't trigger this outright hawkish reaction function from the Fed that we're talking about, but you know, maybe my line in the sand is like at a 5% CPI that really starts to happen, to me that continues to provide a floor and a bid up on equities. So even though we're talking about inflation coming back and we're starting to be, you know, worried about what we just went through in from like 2021 onwards, to me it's slightly different unless we start to see CPI prints above 5, because we're seeing this boom in corporate profits. Do you guys agree with that theory or are you against it?
I'm kind of in the camp that we might be in a productivity boom in certain sectors, and this AI stuff is real. Like I do think that you can have one employee do three people's work now in certain sectors, and it's probably flowing into this corporate profits thing. You know, the other thing no one really kind of talks about is these giant tech companies, the mega tech companies, have so many levers to pull. They can cut costs, you know, reduce overhead. They hired so many people over the past 15 years that largely don't do that much. Like, I mean, there's lots of fat when you grow indefinitely for 15 years. So, you know, you can cut expenses and take away the free lunches. You know, a lot of my buddies in tech are like, why do we have these like lunches every day? That's like gourmet meals and no one eats them. And the buildings are basically empty because everyone works from home. So there's lots of ways to cut costs and increase corporate profits where, I don't know. I think before you get a real credit crisis and inflationary, where inflation gets so bad that you have to sell all these things, you can do so many things with your balance sheet to change them. I mean, including like cut costs, do buybacks, you know, a lot of financial engineering can be had. So I don't know. I'm kind of with you where we could keep seeing this going in a lot of sectors.
Yeah. To me, it's just all about, I mean, obviously the other side of the stock price is the multiple, and, you know, you can look back to past couple of years when multiple, what real rate levels multiples started to get hit. And that's really the factor here. Yeah, you have this tailwind with earnings being nominally based. So you have to get a pretty big multiple hit for a meaningful correction. I think the other angle of this, the other way to think about it is inflationary recessions are way different than deflationary recessions. And that gets to the whole, like 2008 was obviously, you know, you had this huge deflation, you know, 2016. You know, the kind of slowdown there where 0% growth with 0% inflation or say 2% decline in growth with 0% inflation is a negative 2% real. Whereas you might get negative 2% real with 4% inflation and 2% growth, but you're still nominally growing as an economy, which is an environment that's much better for commodities and inflation proxies. And that's why you see those outperformance in like the 60s and 70s. So when you get like a 15% NASDAQ drawdown today at 5% inflation, you know, that's like a 20% real drawdown versus in, you know, 2010s and beyond, you know, you might have had a 20% drawdown with 0% inflation, same thing. So I agree with your logic there. It's just like the thing everybody should be looking for is what's going to roll the multiples.
I think you nailed that. And the multiple, there could be multiple compression in tech. I think that's probably what you're seeing is like a rotation out of Tesla, you know, high CapEx companies with insane valuations. Like, I don't know about those, but
yeah, the ARK ETF. I mean, I in some ways I compare that to altcoins versus Bitcoin, ARK versus QQQ, which is, they're all tech. So people like to bucket them all the same, but underneath they're very different. You know, QQQ is cash flowing big cap tech, ARK is EVs and solar and stuff like that, which is much more speculative. And you have that in the crypto sphere as well with altcoins, you know, huge inflation, lower quality, more speculative. And in both cases, those ratios are just up and to the right. As we're in a different, it's not 2021 where you have helicopter money and every asset goes straight up. You know, it's a much, it's higher for longer environment. Has different ramifications.
Hello, listeners of On the Margin. I've got good news for those of you who are in the crypto scene. Blockworks is bringing back Permissionless. We're going to be doing Permissionless 3, and this year we are heading west. So we're moving that out to Salt Lake City. That's going to be October 9th through 11th this year. We've got a phenomenal lineup of speakers for you. So we've got Balaji headlining. We've got Sriram, Muneeb, Matt Hogan of Bitwise, Jan Van Eck. This one's going to be a blast, guys. And I saw many of you out in London for DAS this year, and I hope to see you out in Salt Lake for Permissionless. And because y'all are such faithful listeners, we've got, if you use code MARGIN10, you're going to get 10% off your tickets. Appreciate you all. Hope to see you out there.
You know, it's interesting to see also these tech companies start to transition to more of this mature phase. I mean, seeing Google start to give out a dividend now, that was quite interesting to me. We've really come full circle from, you know, back in 2000, where we just had the original tech bubble and, you know, half of these companies weren't even making revenues to, okay, now we got a few companies over the last decade who are actually making revenues. You know, they're not quite profitable yet, but we're getting there. Now we're seeing to the point where, boom, we got dividends from these companies now.
Can I talk about that? Because, like, I think your average viewer doesn't know how much that matters, because what it's kind of like, if you think about the evolution of Tesla, where, you know, first they were in like the ARK ETFs, and then they got into the S&P, and then that created this giant push of liquidity. What issuing a dividend does is there is a lot of boomer income funds and yield funds that now can open up and buy your stock. So formerly you're probably just a growth stock, right? And now you can buy that, and it opens up a whole new pool of buyers to that are generally like super huge $50-100 billion funds that can now buy this thing. So that's where it's kind of, they're doing like, these people are very smart with financial engineering. They do it, figure out who the new holder base is as they evolve and what they want and the incentives change. So I thought it was honestly pretty smart. Don't love Google as a company. Think it's probably ruining a lot of human culture. Like, but I mean, you got to give them credit for what they do. You know, they follow like, you know, shareholder incentives. So, you know, I gotta give them credit for that, even if they're going to ruin the entire world and create.
I love that meme that was like that, that meme where it's like boomers rushing to buy Google because they issued a 20-cent dividend. That's pretty good. But your point is right, Tyler, in that like companies, dividends is one of those things, and it's not talked about because no 21st century company issues dividends really, because they hadn't been cash flowing. But you don't stop your dividend like it's nothing. Like it's like the tried true way. When you launch a dividend, that thing is expected to go one way, and that's up growth year over year. And when you cut a dividend, that's like, you know, that's a really, really bad sign. So I think, that's a good point you bring up. And I mean, we're seeing it in the stock price.
You know what? There's another, I just thought of this right now, but generally when you issue a dividend, it's a sign that like you can't grow anymore and your product's been commoditized in a lot of senses. Like you saw Exxon and Chevron are like, they have dividends and it's just the way they keep shareholders, like keep paying them as they get older. And I don't know, maybe this is Google's sign of saying, hey, we have all this cash, but we don't know what to do besides buybacks and dividends because we've already consumed largely, you know, a lot of the tech world. We can't grow that much more. So now we just have to give the money back. So maybe it's secular decline. I don't know. We'll probably follow the path of Facebook and Meta and just do a giant CapEx cycle into AI too.
Yeah, probably for sure. Yeah. Next, off camera, we were talking about at the start here is just this debate that I know both of you may sit on the different sides of the discussion here, but it's just around what's keeping us from actually hitting this 2% inflation target. There's one school of thought, which is that just due to this quote unquote, the term of these days of fiscal dominance is basically setting a floor on inflation and not allowing us to get back to the 2% target. Tyler, I know you've been having some thought experiments on the other side of that discussion. So, you know, maybe we can just start with Tyler, would love to hear your contra view just on that. And then maybe we can just follow up with Quinn on the other side of that one.
You mean just how like, you know, some inflation, like the David Zervos thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Zervos had this in his last week's piece. And I know I mentioned him because he's a good contra, like he's a great contra to keep in mind, but he said Sweden saw one of the highest inflation rates in the list above while their debt to GDP budged from 36 pre-COVID to a peak of 40% during the early stage of the pandemic. And today it's fallen all the way back to 29%. As another example, German debt to GDP went from 60 to 70% and is now back to 65%. Those experiences are hardly comparable to the massive fiscal response which occurred in the US. So Zervos is basically saying like the inflation here is not because of our fiscal deficits and spending. You know, there's countries out there that have done way less deficit spending that had higher rates of inflation. So he was saying it's more of a supply chain issue. And I don't know. I find it hard to reconcile. And I think Quinn it wants to play the contra on this. So why don't you pipe up?
No, I think, you know, the number one thing you see, and I think you see it in investing or these economic or macro viewpoints is just time horizon and people always wanting things to happen sooner than they actually take to play out. For example, you look back to the 70s, the peak to trough, between each peak to trough of the inflation boom bust took about 2 to 3 years. And you know, how we're talking about inflation on a monthly basis and every single month we get a new CPI and we're saying, is it going up or is it going down? And you have to go through that 24 times, before you get to the actual bottom or top of the next cycle. So that just gives you a sense of like how frantic everyone tries to make, you know, at the end of the day, the system is based on trading and activity. And so people are getting a move. But my point here is that, of course, the initial inflation impulse was supply and COVID linked, you know, globally. That's seen in every country that had inflation issues, commodities roofed, oil 2x'd every 6 months from late 2020 to early 22. So that's just a force for inflation you're not going to be able to control. And it's going to be unanimous. But what we're seeing now is the reverberation and reversion of those effects, right? Oil's fallen off and stabilized. Yes, it's strong, but it's only going up, you know, it's a lot less, in like a quarterly basis. And you actually see where the US, had kind of one of the most in check inflation problems. Obviously it was close to 9% or whatever, but the European countries were way worse because partially because they're net importer of energy status, whereas we're net exporter. But what you've seen now is the US rate of inflation, when you plot it against UK and Japan and Europe, we're actually above all of them. They have all come down, continue to come down, and we haven't. And so I think you have to look at like, not just like year one And I think the real test will be over the next few years. And to me, that's what, you know, gold and some of these things are pricing is like, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice. Like we're still seeing how these rampant fiscal deficits really play out, over multi-year basis. And I just, it's very difficult for me to see that it's not a U.S. Fiscal driven thing.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think a simple framework is like, okay, if we go back to when CPI was at 9%, a couple years ago, if we have 2% of that being attributed to the neutral rate of interest of the economy, you know, maybe 5% of that was supply driven, supply chain issues that were, you know, making things really painful. And then maybe another 2% that was fiscally driven. And so now as we come back, okay, well, we have the 2% neutral rate of interest. We've taken out that 5% that was supply crisis driven. These supply chains have mostly resolved themselves. So now we're left with this residual 2%, basically floor from fiscal, in my opinion. And that would make a lot of sense to me because, you know, we're seeing this fact that inflation is bottoming out around, you know, 3.5-4%. And so it's making it a lot harder to get down to that neutral rate because you have that residual.
Yeah. And the, like, it's going to be really interesting, I think, later this year when, you know, we've already seen the easing impulse from every global central bank, including the U.S. to some extent, but their hands have been tied by our growth and our inflation. But for example, Europe, we came into this year, you know, 6-7 cuts in the U.S., which is insane. And Europe was supposed to start cutting after us. And now we're down to 0-1 and Europe's cutting, you know, expected 2 or 3. So I think the dollar, and the U.S. liquidity buffer between the RRP has been a big driver of what's allowed this to kind of go on. And, mm-hmm. you know, still, there's still like over $1 trillion between TGA and RRP of liquidity to keep it going. So, you know, if there's one thing we know, it's that U.S. policymakers and Yellen know how to, you know, finagle these things.
I find it really funny that as we discuss all of this, we haven't even really mentioned the Fed, who are supposed to be mandated with price stability. I mean, what do they even do in this situation? Like, would they've hiked rates to 5.5% and we're still like, obviously they've done some psychological jawboning, approaches to juicing the markets a bit. I think we can admit that, but like from a mechanical, you know, policy standpoint, like they're using their tools and they're not working. Like, what does the Fed do?
See, I think there's like bigger structural things here too. And like take into account, I think it's like, China loses 3 million employees in the workforce per year. That number is going to like 8 per year soon. So wages are going to go up globally because that's your incremental on the margin wage and in a globalized labor supply. And then you take, I guess, like demographics here as baby boomers kind of drop out of the workforce and you have wage increases for the millennials and Gen Zers and Gen Xers. I think they have to raise their inflation target because it's going to be really tough when you see that labor supply shrink in a globalized world, especially if it starts deglobalizing and the inflation risks get higher. And to a certain extent, it's going to probably resolve itself where you delever the economy with inflation over long period of time, and maybe it turns into a 70s. Maybe you have a productivity boom and AI turns out really great and we muddle through this thing as we delever the economies. But in either way, I think at some point the policymakers will come out and say, we're going to raise our target, or just say, hey, we're going to target nominal GDP at this point. There's going to be something that, and it's probably within the next 6 months to a year, I'm guessing, which is a tectonic shift. We saw yesterday there was some chatter about Trump changing, you know, the Fed, I guess, like taking control of the Fed. I don't know if you guys saw that.
I put this quote in here, but about basically having Trump set policy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like that's the world we're inevitably going into. you know, like Biden doing the, they're all trying to figure out what policies will work in the populist basis. Inevitably, you're just going to end up with inflation, just like you did in the Weimar Republic.
I think that piece, I saw Paulo Macro on Twitter had a take on that piece. He's like, you know, why am I reading this now? And there's like all the sources were like sources say, and you know, estimate, like it's just, it was, his take was that it was a piece to kind of motivate Jerome Powell to, you know, support the economy in the election and, you know, reignite that distaste for the orange man. I actually kind of believe it. Like, let's be honest, like Trump is not going to run the Federal Reserve.
I don't know. I mean, crazier things have happened.
Crazier things have happened. I mean, Ukraine elected a comedian as their president.
We have a drama teacher here, so.
Yeah. The thing that we were talking about before too is maybe it's a good time to touch on is the, you always hear like occasionally this argument on Twitter, like are higher rates stimulative? I think it's just like a ponderance of, you know, why has, and we all talk about this, fiscal is the driver of why the U.S. economy has remained so strong. And some people posit like, oh, are these high rates actually stimulative? And I think that's just very much not the case. Like, if Powell kept the short-term rate low, you'd have a steep yield curve, a regularly shaped yield curve, and banks would be lending left and right. You'd have credit creation. You'd have everybody that finances themselves on a short-term basis with floating rate loans would have a heyday, and you'd have a huge tailwind to economic activity. So I think that, like you said, Powell's doing everything he can, like without breaking things. And then we see them break things occasionally. And then, you know, you get things batted down. But
can I play the contra on that in some way?
Yeah.
Like, look what Meta did. They're increasing CapEx massively as rates go higher. Maybe it's like this like counterintuitive thing where if rates are higher, you're forced to try to invest in new growth down the line instead of just like buy back your stock.
Where, like, no, there's no way.
It's so easy to come by when rates are low that you're like, well, we could, like, why would we do a large CapEx cycle when rates are so low and we can just, you know, borrow money and buy back our stock? Like, so, do you know what I'm saying?
Well, what they do with that money is one thing, but the funding is what all we're talking about, which is,
yeah,
cheaper. I just think the Fed doesn't, like what we keep saying is like the Fed doesn't matter here because it's just fiscal. Like they try to be restrictive and then they break the market and they have to reverse. And it's just like.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of agree with this idea that there's a little bit of line fitting going on with saying this, you know, presumption that, you know, high interest rates is stimulative. You know, I think more so the driving factor is just how it turned out. Corporate debt is, as well as you know, residential mortgages are, you know, a lot of people lock those 30 years in at 2-2.5%. As long as they don't move, they're not affected by interest rates, and so their biggest, you know, basically fixed payments are not affected by the Fed. I think it's more so just that it's less restrictive, but I don't know if I agree that it's completely stimulative like people are saying. But I think because of how fixed it is, yeah.
Because the most countries don't have fixed term mortgages, and that's actually, I saw this chart yesterday. It's like, you know, kind of making fun of like when leaders say policy is restrictive right now, and it showed like home prices year over year growth, and it's like 12%, 11%, 10%, like all these big U.S. metros, and like you said, yeah, that's a huge asset when your liabilities, you know, homeowners today are in the green on their home asset price and in the green on the value of their loan has significantly decreased as rates have gone higher. Whereas every other country, you know, where it's a floating rate instrument, you get screwed with
higher rates. In Canada, even a fixed rate, we got to refinance every 5 years. So that's why we're so desperate to cut right now, is because literally every mortgage
it's coming up
refinance.
You know what's happening? Is this like the ARM cycle in the U.S.? It kind of feels like it is happening in Canada. Like everyone's been talking about the Canadian housing bubble imploding for, I don't know, years. And maybe it's actually coming this time, just like, you know, the Widowmaker trade in Japan is actually like working now.
Yeah, it's either that or they start cutting and the Canadian dollar tanks. It's, you know, it's a real tough situation to be in. But I think it's coming for that reason, is that even on a 30-year mortgage, you have to refinance every 5 years.
So I think what we're all saying is just like the inevitability is you have to make home ownership possible. Did you see the Scott Galloway rant, by the way?
No, like, I do love Scott, but I didn't. Yeah.
You know, he was on MSNBC and he was like, you know, if you're a millennial, you should be pissed. You know, if you're a Gen Zer, you should be pissed. You're basically locked out of like all these things and the boomers are spending it on your credit card. And it's kind of like, I mean, he kind of nails it. The angst in our generation, like, and to speak on the mortgage thing, like luckily, like I locked in a mortgage during those years and it was a really low rate. And now knowing if there's a house that opens in our neighborhood, it's bid up in like 2 seconds, goes, you know, 200,000 over asking easy, even with rates this high. It's
still,
it's kind of bizarre. And like the same thing, my hometown is Ridgewood, New Jersey. It's like a little suburb in New York City. And it's the same thing there where like, if you have, you know, any open house still at these rates goes crazy because there's no supply and like people are dying in our generation to like settle down, have children. And it's really in it. They also are like paying up too much and they're kind of in a precarious position. So there's just a lot of imbalances that can go wrong. But inevitably, I think what we're all saying is like, those are the majority of the taxpayers the next 10 years. You have to lower rates so they can service the debt, right? And you're going to end up creating way more inflation down the line and nominal growth, no matter what. And even if it's Canada or the US, right?
To that point, Tyler, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about is your theory and this generational arbitrage where, you know, real estate is a mess for young people, but we have this opportunity to buy Bitcoin. But, you know, throughout everything that we've talked about today, Bitcoin ETF flows have been flat for a couple months now. The price has just been ranging. I mean, I think it's pretty clear where a lot of this is going. Like, are people just waiting for it to be really like waiting for the catalyst to occur and they don't want to wait it out? Why do you guys think this hasn't been, you know, accretive to Bitcoin flows lately?
It's a little puzzling. I don't know. My read is you did have a lot of inflows during the past month when the ETFs went live. And now it's like, what's unlocking the next stage? Felix, you've been talking about the demand. It's like you need something to unlock, and like Morgan Stanley, whether it's Morgan Stanley unlocking it for their advisors, or there's got to be another pocket, and maybe we get it with Hong Kong here in a couple of days. Not many people have talked about that. So there's got to be that increased concentric circle of adoption that happens. And we're kind of just in a channel here from 60 to 70K at this point until there's incremental demand or supply or reasons to sell.
Yeah. I just don't think there's a catalyst in the market. Like if something comes along and spurs a positive change, I think things could get interesting again. Maybe next Wednesday, QRA could be that from a macro front with liquidity, but there just hasn't been a catalyst. And then you have stablecoin flows slowing while Bitcoin ETF flows have gone negative and over $10 billion of alt inflation, supply inflation on a monthly basis. Like eventually, you know, BTC has been supported above everything else, but you know, eventually it kind of drags it down with it. And you have this apathy forming where we've seen leverage lower, funding rates down. And I've been a resident bear on
that. Like that, I thought that was a great point, is funding rates are negative and we've never been this high in Bitcoin with funding rates negative. So there's no leverage in it right now, right?
No. The answer is Athena, because there's 2.5 billion of, 2.5 billion.
It has skewed funding rates a little bit.
People don't understand. Convo for a different day because there's too much alpha in there, but people don't understand the effects that Athena is actually having on the funding market.
Gotcha. Okay. So there's this other thing.
Have you heard about Athena yet, Tyler?
No. See, this is where I'm too macro and I should.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but this is where your background will you'll find this funny. So Athena basically came out with this product where it's basically a collateralized stablecoin where there's a yield attributed to it that's basically based on two things, the ETH proof of stake yield, but then basically basically a positive carry on buying spot ETH and then shorting the perp and collecting that funding rate. So it's basically like a packaged up like futures carry trade and just basically stacked on top of each other.
Okay.
You've created this yield. So basically they just like, you know, packaged up a futures carry trade.
Yeah.
And because of that, there's been this huge steady compression of funding rates basically because that yield has been coming lower because there's this much higher open interest on the short side.
Gotcha. Okay. The artificially, suppressing that. Interesting.
Yeah. Which is funny. I mean, that's classic crypto. It's just repeating what's in TradFi. It's just like, okay, this is just a carry trade in a package. But
yeah, that's not leveraged, is it?
No, but they've done it in a more capital efficient way than anybody can put it on because the exchanges are giving them on exchange credit against their staked ETH. So basically, you can't put staked ETH on exchange and short the future and do this. But they have these arrangements with qualified custody providers that allows them to hold the staked ETH in the exchange. So it's like, and then on top of that, they've incentivized the hell out of it with token rewards. And so it's really ramped up the volumes above probably what it should be. So that's where you get this dislocation in funding markets where everyone's like, oh my God, it's negative. And it's like, no, they're VC capital incentivizing people to put on the basis arb, which is pushing funding down. And if you have a prolonged period of weakness or apathy in the market, that's going to get unwound. And when that unwinds, funding actually goes up without price actually moving. And then all of a sudden it looks way less constructive. Mm. So that's the worst case scenario for crypto right now is that we just in this holding pattern. Cause I don't think time is on bull side, like price leaks if there's no catalyst in my opinion here, which is why I've been the resident bear on Twitter. Look, I am the first one who prefers to be a bull than a bear, but I don't like losing money.
I mean, it's good. It's good to have the contra. You guys got to tell me when we get the three arrows type leverage again. And
the bright side is that is not even close to back. And
yeah,
I don't see any avenues to that coming back. So that's a positive. Like that should really dampen the downside volatility of this market, right? Like think of all the forced sellers you had through 2022. Alts, who knows? There's no buyer of last resort there when you're some of those. But on Corn and ETH and Sol, you probably have some.
Can you give me the lowdown about like Bitcoin DeFi? Because for some reason, I know it's like clunky. This is my like very high level read. It's clunky. It's hard to be a developer on Bitcoin, yada, yada, yada. Why isn't this bigger? Because the market cap, like the Bitcoin dominance is going up. Are you seeing developers move more into the Bitcoin world on the DeFi side?
Yeah. The talk of every VC right now is Bitcoin DeFi and infrastructure. The problem is that the Bitcoin, you can't build on Bitcoin. So there's different ways. I'm not an expert here either, but my understanding is there's many different ways to come at it from the how to build it. Most of which are projects building on EVM style compatible setups first with the goal that in a couple of years or whenever this tech is ready, there's changes made to the Bitcoin network that allow these applications and other layers to adopt Bitcoin security. But right now it's not possible with the way the network Bitcoin network set up. So every VC is now pivoted to like VCs used to hate Bitcoin. And now they're like everybody's like, oh my God, I'm so excited about Bitcoin DeFi and Bitcoin applications. So
see, isn't that what you need? You need the CapEx cycle to go there. It last cycle was like these weird nonsensical, like I couldn't even explain it. Like these people would send me, you know, this is a protocol that does X, Y, and Z. And then I'd be like, but can you like simplify it? Like I'm in third grade and kind of like give me it. They couldn't do it. But anyway, my long story short is all these VCs in Bitcoin now will eventually, it's kind of like the dial up internet, right? It was super clunky. Your web page took a while to load. And then all the CapEx came in. They figured it out. Like this, I mean, it'll take years probably, but I guess I'm it just makes so much sense to me to eventually have DeFi on Bitcoin, but I'm not a programmer and I can't bridge that gap.
If that were to occur, where do you guys think that leaves Ethereum? Because, you know, on one side of the equation, you have high throughput Solana type idea. And on the other side, like if we were able to get Bitcoin with effective DeFi, like to me is like a, you know, not a fully closeted Bitcoin maxi, but like if we were able to have, you know, Bitcoin's monetary policy that is a lot more immutable than Ethereum's, but able to have that EVM style compatibility, like that's pretty powerful to me. Where do you guys think that leads Ethereum?
Isn't that why the ratio between Bitcoin and Ethereum is kind of breaking down a little bit?
Probably.
That'll be interesting.
Well, ETH, yeah, there's a lot. ETH's also about to be get a lawsuit from the SEC for being a security. So that's also the other thing. But I'm speculating. But the consensus news yesterday kind of confirmed that there's significant moving pieces in the background. But yeah, I just think one of the problems with crypto is everyone wants to be everything. Like everybody wants to be money, and they also want to be the internet, and they also want to be like an application. And in reality, Bitcoin is great as gold, like a store of value. And you can't, like we've seen gold doesn't work as well as other currencies and, you know, global monetary systems, you know, forever. Otherwise we'd have gold. So that's where I kind of like, I just think like you probably fade the either directions because we're not going to know for 5 years anyways.
Yeah. That's probably the right move is that, you know, we're just following narratives and crypto. Yeah, yeah. Chase a narrative to its most logical extreme. And
yeah, exactly.
Now it's like, all right, we don't need Ethereum. We're good.
And when there's still multi-billion dollars of oversupplied capital allocation to crypto venture that needs to get rinsed, people just move narrative to narrative. And, you know, we've seen there hasn't been a lot of innovation actually but as a result of it. So I have to put on skeptic lenses when I view that rush to Bitcoin.
Well, look, we got a few minutes left here, but we'd love to chat a bit about, you know, it's obviously there's a lot of macro going on right now, a lot coming up in the next couple of weeks. Maybe Quinn, you just want to tee us off here, just talking a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of this upcoming QRA and its potential market impact. I think, you know, we're generally aligned that has a lot more larger implications than the next Fed meeting, but we'd be curious on your analysis there.
Yeah, my take is that so next week's the big week. I think markets risk across the board, stocks and crypto are looking for the next catalyst. And to me, the most obvious potential for that is the macro side with next Wednesday's QRA and FOMC. It's a sign of the times that people actually know what QRA is now. In the past, it didn't even ever matter. And in my opinion, you know, you can fade this, right? You can say, oh, like it's when it's the most talked about thing, it's not a big deal. I saw a report from Goldman that the expectation here in the market is just status quo, basically the same as last time, where the TGA stays at 750 and there's net bills reduction and net coupons issuance. But I actually think that it's, again, to the trend of fiscal dominance, it actually is more important than the FOMC because there's nothing we're going to learn about monetary policy on Wednesday. We know hikes are priced out way far, 6 to 12 months away. We know that that QT taper is not super imminent. It might be 3 months, it might be 6 months, it might be 9 months, but it's not that big of a deal. And what we do find out though is how the US Treasury is going to spend down what I view as almost, you know, basically $1.2 trillion of excess capital between the TGA and RRP. And so to me, that's capital Yellen's already paying for. She's paying an interest rate on that to have it outstanding, and it's sitting there idle. Going into the election this year, I really struggled to see a reason she wouldn't tap into that. We've pre-COVID, the standard RRP size was zero, and the standard TGA size was below 100 billion. So we're talking, you know, there's a lot of people on Twitter speaking about, you know, Andy Constant. He's like the absolute expert in this topic. So, you know, I think I'm going a little bit against what his view is, but you know, we're caught up in these short term things. But I just think the norm is these facilities are zero, and Yellen's paying for that capital anyway. So I don't see why she wouldn't goose it into the election. And with the higher the yen goes, it literally just keeps going up on our screen during this recording. It's Friday at noon Eastern, and it's, you know, almost pushing 158, and the higher that goes, the more Yellen has to act, I think, here. And that could be the next thing. So that's what I'm watching. I don't think you need to front run it because literally nobody knows. But that's what I think could be the next catalyst.
Yeah. I definitely agree with a lot of that. Tyler, what are you looking at into the next week here?
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. You know, I think, you know, this week was the majority of earnings with that rolling off and nothing really blowing up besides Meta so far. I think it'll calm things down. Realize volatility hasn't really spiked that much. So I think the implieds, everyone bought a lot of downside protection. I still think those roll off lower here. Like the VIX will fall and we'll be back in some sort of status quo. You also had a lot of CTA supply over the past couple of weeks. I don't know if you followed Scott Rubner at Goldman, but he's really good with quant CTA flow. And that should probably end. So this is lining up kind of interesting with what Quinn said is, global liquidity and the Michael Howell framework is it could really go up here after taking like a month long hiccup. So stuff we're paying attention to, we'll see if it comes to fruition or the yen goes out of control and causes a crazy credit crisis.
Yeah, pretty much. It's so tough because now that, you know, this area of fiscal dominance means we have to analyze politics, which is difficult. And it takes in a lot of your own personal beliefs. And then also you have to decide personally, like, what your level of cronyism you believe is in institutions right now. So it's like if you're somebody who believes that, you know, Yellen is totally objective and there's no sort of goosing into the election, you might have a different opinion from somebody who thinks that Yellen is there to make sure that they win the election and that good, happy markets will achieve that for them. So it makes it really hard to analyze markets these days because you have to be thinking within those lenses.
Welcome to the fourth turning.
Welcome to the fourth turning. Yeah.
Guys, I got a jet here for a call, but really, really good hour session. Love it.
Yeah. Great. That's stuff.
Great.
Have a good weekend, everybody.